roll up my sleeves. How about that? I'm good. Any food news? Any supermarket adventures? Puzzling claims? Okay, I got one, but not too big. Maybe you'll think of some on your mind. Mine actually comes from a different topic that I was studying. I've been interested in reading about civility. I'm not sure why. It seems like a good topic these days. And so I'm reading these texts, different things about it. And of course, civility does come into connection with food. I just hadn't thought about it. I mean, for me, it was like a separate research topic. But a couple times there has been a connection, because after all, being civil at the table is part of civility. You know, mostly we think of maybe political discourse. But so I'm reading this very wonderfully short book. I really love short books. And I just want to read a paragraph about it, about civility at the table. Because we don't always appreciate that. We have, hey, that's fine. Come on in. I'll just read it, and then maybe it'll explain itself. If I can find it. Uh-oh. Yeah, it's right. Okay, here we go. We can see the communicative power of civility at work whenever people gather to eat. One might think that table manners are a relatively unimportant matter, at most concerned with good hygiene. Yet the sharing of food with others is an important public act, and the style in which we dine transmits important messages about the sort of people we are. During the Middle Ages, as Norbert Elias argued, it was considered appropriate for people to freely express their passions in public. And that's covering for kind of a crude things that people used to do that was pretty crude in public, actually. And subject only to a few blunt controls. Table manners of the time provided a means for displaying that one was acceptably constrained. So eating from the same plate or dish as others was taken for granted. We don't usually appreciate that a lot of medieval tables people would have served the food in a big plate, and you wouldn't have been given an individual portion. So you had to demonstrate civility in the way you took food from the plate. So you had to kind of know who got to go first and how much they got to take, and you know what I mean? So there was a kind of pecking order there. One must only refrain from falling on the dish like a pig and from dipping bitten food into the communal sauce. As the idea of a more finely calibrated and controlled public behavior gained currency, the gradual development of rules for using forks, spoons, individual plates, and napkins offered new ways of projecting one's more delicate and refined qualities. Dining etiquette has never been merely a matter of cleanliness. Instead, it has always been a language for communicating information about our trustworthy disposition and our social belonging. Someone whose table manners differ from our own is someone we may find a little unnerving. Henry Hitchens writes, I like this quote, "If he eats a tomato like that, what else is he capable of?" Isn't that great? So the idea here is that, you know, we didn't have table manners initially, but table manners are part of the way you communicate a sense of identity, a sense of, you know, who you are. So it led to kind of an interesting question that in the last class we actually got some pretty good data on. So maybe you guys have some responses. What are some things that you have trouble dealing with if in terms of other people's eating behavior? Yeah, right. Not hard to locate. Like, I've got a list. I got my list here. Yeah, what do you do? Start
chewing
to talk.
With their mouth open.
Yeah, absolutely. Why is that
the
service?
Table.
What? Oh, elbows bother you.
Loud.
Okay.
Cutting noises, or like when they shake the whole table.
Aggressive cutting. Yeah, that came up in the last class. Aggressive. Anything aggressive. Holding a fork. Somebody said in the last class, he was demonized for holding his fork like this. And you know who that is? And I read somewhere else that one reason you don't want to hold your utensils like this is that if people held a knife like this, it would be the way you would hold it to like stab the guy next to you. So there are some practical considerations here. But yeah, that's a good start. Others? Yes?
Off of the chewing with your mouth up, or chewing loud, like talking with your mouth full. Like,
yeah.
A lot of people just like cover their mouth, but they're
keep talking?
Chewing.
Yeah. So even covering doesn't help for you?
No.
Smacking noises are the worst. I mean, Food enjoyment noises, I'm okay with. I mean, in some cultures, you have to make them as a sign of appreciation, right? You have to slurp to show that you like it. Yeah, what else? Anything else? Slurping. Slurping, yeah, even though you know, I mean, I'm telling you, there are cultures where that's the way you show your host that you're not into that. Okay, neither am I.
A lack of neck mucus, I know a lot of people.
I know, finger licking, finger and mouth licking, I'm not really okay with that. But, you know, I would. These are things you don't say, right, unless it's your kid, right?
And
you
go, like,
what?
Unless you're eating
Cheetos. There are exemptions for Cheetos and Doritos. Because they have sticky stuff that is just too good to waste.
It's like, if you didn't wash your hands before you started eating them, it's like, oh, man.
Actually, eating in unhygienic environments bothers me. Like, when people just kind of, well, anyway, yeah, please.
So I've actually done some research on this, because it's like, it drives me through.
Yeah.
I can't hear any sound. Like, I can't even hear myself chew. Mm-hmm. But it's mental illness that we're starting to like figure out that there's a part in your brain that like certain people have this part in the brain that's bigger or stronger than others, and that's why it causes us to hate that sound.
Which behavior? The smacking sound?
No. Yeah, there's different sounds that trigger different.
Interesting. Oh, so there's research on this. That's cool. And it actually lights up disgust reactions or
Like that. It came out in the early 2000s.
Wow. And does this research help us say who's sensitive, help us predict who it bothers, or no? It's just there's a neural correlate. That's cool.
Yeah,
absolutely.
There's different sounds, like, sometimes.
One of my weird pet peeves, I don't know if any of you share it, is when I'm at a restaurant, if I'm sitting at a table with some people, and the table next to me, the people are leaving, if they hover too long, like near my table, like I'm having a meal, and if somebody's standing next to me and they're adjusting their coat, they're getting their stuff together, it just drives me. Yeah, I know, that's a weird one, right? That's a peculiar one. Any others that are common? We've hit a lot of them.
Throat.
What?
My dad does.
Clearing throat, clearing. Yeah, throat clearing. Yeah, I feel, my father-in-law is like that, and I feel bad because it's kind of an old man thing. But, people, in the last class, somebody said, several people agreed that when people get up from the table a lot and interrupt the meal with other activities, like go do something and come back, or even when the host, you know, this is often a maternal behavior, you know, the mom is like serving food and she's up and down all a lot, which, you know, that kind of goes with the service, I guess. Yeah, anything else? Good stuff. Let's get into our article. Like I said, you know, this is a busy week. I didn't schedule a huge amount of reading. You guys have a lot of midterms. You have a lot of things to get to, including the assignment you did for me. So let's enjoy the chapter. Let's get some details out about it. Oh, right. Before we get to that, though, I do want to underline this. It's not a big point, but I wanted to kind of call attention to it. Last class, we were talking about the semiotics of food in the Bible, right? Gene Solar. And I thought we kind of got to an interesting conclusion that I wanted to reinforce, because it had, well, at least it was new to me. And it's the idea that all diets are philosophies of food. You see, philosophy of food is kind of a new area for philosophers to work in. So there's a little bit of a, you know, is there really something there kind of attitude. And some of my colleagues will tease me about that. Like, okay, so, you know, they get food ethics as philosophy of food, but this is more like, this is not quite the same as a food ethics class. But I guess I'd been telling you there's this consensus diet, you know, that's a kind of whole food, avoid, you know, all the stuff Pollan has said, right, and all the stuff you've read in some of the other readings. And it didn't occur to me until we were talking about religion and food that what I labeled whole foodism last week, which would be the kinds of beliefs you would have to really buy into the whole food diet that people advocate today, you know. Not too much meat, back off the industrial food, you know, all the eating algorithms that Pollan said. And I really started to see that as a philosophical diet now. I didn't see it that way before. I always thought, but the point for me was that the facts about food and nutrition they underdetermine the diet. In other words, there's no set of facts you're going to learn, in my opinion, anyway, right now, that's going to tell you what to eat. All the facts do is they specify kind of a range of possible diets. to actually get an actual diet, you have to kind of invest in a number of commitments about how you see your place in the world. Now, that doesn't mean you have to buy into a whole food diet. You could say, well, you know, the way I see my place in the world, industrial diets and Soylent, you know, the all-chemical diet, you know, those are fine. But see, that's a philosophy. That's a way of saying, you know, my food doesn't have to be tied to nature so much. And whether that's a good or bad philosophy isn't the point right now, right? The point is to say the facts don't determine a diet. They only set ranges. And to get a diet, you have to kind of commit implicitly or explicitly to a kind of understanding of how you fit into the world and to fit into nature and, right? And what your eating is doing, you know, for your identity. So that was also brought home to me by the paleos. You know, my other section doesn't have any paleo dieters. You guys, we have a couple, right? Do you always do that diet? Oh, no. Oh, I thought that was something you did. No, just periodically. Or no, not at all.
It's really hard at school.
Ah, okay. And you do it all the time. So the paleo diet, I was initially very skeptical, you know, when you brought it up last semester, and I was like, oh, my God. and no, really, I was just totally like, remember the reaction I had? I was kind of like, really? You do that? And I went and researched it, and I had to acknowledge that, yeah, it's a real diet. It's a healthy diet. I mean, people, you know, nutritionists will, it's not, you notice it's not the consensus mainstream diet. Balance your carbs, fats, and proteins that we're going to, you know, learn more about in the next few weeks. But the point is, it's a diet that involves a kind of orientation to the world. It could be because, you know, maybe wheat doesn't go down well for you, but it could be that it just works for your body, right? And so you make this kind of commitment. This is who I am. This diet works better for me than what everybody else is eating. And so again, it brought home to me that all diets involve a philosophy of food. The other way that this was brought home to me is by this Vietnamese medical anthropologist I've told you about, Stephen Lee, 100 million years of food. And he makes the point that, you know, he comes from Vietnam, but he's American, Canadian raised, and, you know, he went to UCLA. And he makes the point in this book that, you know, we think the Western diet is normative for people around the world to be healthy, but it's not. You know, people in Vietnam often don't eat vegetables for months. You know, it's not necessarily, you don't necessarily have to eat vegetables. And I'm like, what do you mean? How can that be true? You know, in this culture, you know, we talk about how we need to be eating more vegetables. You know, so it's not like there's a truth about the matter of whether you have to have vegetables in your diet. That's a pretty big difference, right? And so when you look at global diets, you kind of realize, and special diets that work and that are medically sound, you kind of realize that our diets always take us beyond the evidence. They always involve kind of holistic commitments, either implicit or explicit, to kind of a way of being. So it's neat because it's a way of saying that food matters a lot. And Elizabeth, I'm burning up here. We can't open the window for a little while?
Yeah, I sweet rolled up your sleeves.
I know. I did my part. Do you have any other jackets you can wear?
I wish.
Do you want? That's okay. We'll do it for just a couple minutes. It won't pass out.
It's okay.
Okay. All right. So let's go ahead and turn to our reading. If you have it on your screen or you can pull it up on the screen, that'd be great. I'd like you to chime in with some things. And again, this is, I think we just kind of enjoy the details. There's some clear points to make here for philosophy of food, and then we'll probably be able to harvest a little time at the end for your busy schedules. But there's a lot of cool stuff in here. So. Let's not go too fast. Okay, you might want to take a few notes on each section. Basically, you know, you get a section in this article on the first Thanksgiving, so we'll start there, 1621. Then you get a section on European diets, and this is really good because it gets Galen into the discussion. We haven't really talked about humoral eating. And then she goes, you know, she's been talking about the European pilgrims coming to Cape Cod, and then she backs up and talks about their diet. And then there's a section on Jamestown, which actually occurs in 1607. That's another colony that had a similar and different experience with Native Americans. And then finally she ends with a comment on the way Puritans perceived their diet as part of, as both a rebellion against the culture that they came from and has a unified moral worldview. Okay, and again, that moralism in our diets is not just, you know, that's still in our diets today, right? Okay, so let's just talk about the first Thanksgiving. Was there some surprises in here for you? How much have you been exposed to this story? Because, you know, it's not the story I got when I was growing up, right? The story I got was that the smart Europeans came to North America and helped the poor savage Indians eat well that day. That's a really different story than what you learn in this article, right? So what do you learn in this article? Let's see. You get a little description of the Mayflower diet, and the diet on the Mayflower, which was pretty horrible, a ship's diet. We're back to ship's biscuits, which was a common food. Lots of scurvy. 40 of the voyagers died the first winter after arriving. And then you learn that when they first arrive, they're on Cape Cod, and they find a store of Indian corn that was carefully stored away, and they just take it. And they tell themselves a story about how God put it there for them, because they're religious pilgrims, right? They're coming here for religious freedom. But they also know that they've stolen something, because they know there's Indians, they know they're going to meet them, they hadn't met them yet at this point. And so they do actually pay for it. So there's kind of a dual sense in the narrative that they understand they have a debt here. So in their early experience, they have this encounter with a guy named Tisquantum. And by the way, I should back up and tell you, because I want to recommend this book. So Wallach is reflecting a new 30 years of history research, which has revised our picture of the encounter of Europeans with North Americans. And in the old picture, in the old history, and this is a great summer history. If you like to pick a good big history book every summer, this is one I read a couple years ago, and it's great. And then there's another one, 1494, I think. So this is intentionally titled, you know, for the year before Columbus arrives, right? So it's the story of South America, Mesoamerica, and North America prior to Columbus's arrival. And you learn all kinds of amazing stuff. Stuff that was never in even, maybe in some of your high school history courses. Maybe it got in there. But a lot of this is from a revisionist history. So you don't need to take notes on this, but one of the revisions was that we thought that Europeans encountered a largely empty continent. And that's not true at all, right? The Indian city, there were cities of Indians, where there were maybe many thousands of Indians. We've revised the number upwards of how many people were living in all three places, you know, North, Central, and South America. Now there's some estimates that, you know, up to 1 million people were living in North America at the time the pilgrims arrived. And we also have revised you've probably heard this part, I had heard this part before. We've revised our understanding of the way disease spread through North America, because the crucial point is that diseases traveled faster than the people. So you have a detail in this chapter where the pilgrims do you remember this one? It's a kind of weird, small detail. The pilgrims move inland from Cape Cod, and they encounter vacant cultivated fields. Did you remember that one? That's kind of an interesting detail. And in the revisionist history now, the new history, what we know is that disease traveled very fast, and by the time more Europeans were arriving, there had been entire towns that were vacated through through death from disease. And so the pilgrims actually encountered some of that in their experience. So that's part of this different story to tell. And the other another part of it is that historians in the last few decades have gone through original source material and just got a much richer picture of Native Americans, their food habits, I mean, all kinds of things, but especially food, and how they perceived Europeans. And just a small detail, but in 1491, there's a really interesting account of several accounts of how Indians perceived Europeans as pretty gross, like really smelly. Like a 17th century European would not bathe. Like bathing wasn't something that happened. And wasn't considered healthy to bathe, if you can imagine. And Native Americans didn't smell, according to the Europeans' accounts. And they were healthy. And we know from forensic evidence the forensic anthropology that Native American bones show evidence of a very high nutritional diet. So Native Americans were eating very well. It was a very different culture. It was a violent culture. Native American communities were at war with each other frequently. So I don't want to paint too rosy a picture, but you see where I'm going with this? I mean, it was not a case that the Native Americans were poor and few and poorly fed, and the Europeans were well-fed and well-organized. The picture you get here is that the Europeans didn't really know what they were doing, even though they weren't the first Europeans to come. They were vulnerable. A lot of them died on the way. A lot of them died the first winter. So then Tisquantum comes along, and remember, we call him Squanto sometimes. The settlers called him Squanto. And he's an interesting character. He gets a lot of pages in 1491 because he had been captured by British and enslaved, brought to Britain for a number of years as a slave, freed himself, and got himself back to North America. So he's a pretty interesting character. So in the chapter, you remember where he comes up to the settlers and he's speaking perfect English. And that's pretty cool. I mean, he's a kind of example of this, how complicated this culture is, and so we wouldn't have imagined that. He wasn't in the original narratives, I guess, in the same way. And the significant point here is that he helps the pilgrims. He helps them learn how to plant. He teaches them how to plant. A very interesting detail that you'll hear if you read about food is that Native Americans planted corn, beans, and squash in the same place. And that was sometimes referred to as the Three Sisters. And the idea is that the corn provides a stalk for the beans and the roots of the beans interact with bacteria to fix nitrogen in the soil, right? And then the squash spread out and they reduce weed growth. So the three plants work together. So the Indians didn't know about nitrogen, of course, but they had a very ecologically sound way of planting. They had plenty of, they were hunter-gatherers. They were farmers to some extent, but they were largely hunter-gatherers. They ate in abundance. We'll talk about their food a little later in another section, which you might remember. So some of their food was difficult for Europeans to stomach. So getting right to the Thanksgiving meal, right? What we learn is that there was a feast. It didn't involve turkeys. It involved a bunch of guys and a bunch of Indians killing a bunch of meat, a bunch of deer, a bunch of birds, and eating really well. So there was a kind of feast. But the important point for your notes is that for a pilgrim, a Thanksgiving meal would be a kind of meal in which you gave thanks, as opposed to, say, a fast, where you refrained from eating for religious purposes. So a Thanksgiving meal wouldn't have been a commemorative meal at that time, and it would have just been a type of meal, an ordinary ritual, not an annual commemoration. And even when we make it a national holiday, this is a good point for your notes, let's get the timeline on Thanksgiving here. So nobody celebrated Thanksgiving as a commemorative holiday from 1621 to 1861. It just, there continued to be Thanksgivings because that was a religious ritual connecting food to thanking God for food. But then even after Lincoln declares it a national holiday in 1861, it's not tied to the pilgrims. Isn't that interesting? It's just like, okay, let's have a national day of Thanksgiving. And then this writer, this woman in the late 19th century, connects it to the pilgrims, and that's when we start using it to commemorate a founding moment. Now, interestingly, that's the late 19th century. What is happening in the late 19th century, early 20th century? Massive waves of immigration. My grandparents came over and 1912, I think it was. And so connecting Thanksgiving to the founders, the pilgrims at least, was a way of, according to Wallach, and I think she's right, it was a way of promoting assimilation for immigrants. In other words, the holiday gets defined as a national food holiday when we need a holiday to start to bring people into this melting pot. It's a cool story. It connects American culture to food, the founding. And also, the Civil War. You can imagine Lincoln's probably thinking, wow, maybe this will be a unifying event for us. What the hell? We've just killed 600,000 of our fellow citizens in this war. Or we're in the process of doing it. It's 1861. Okay, so that's kind of the story of Thanksgiving. What I want you to get out of your notes, maybe make an extra note here, is that the true story of the Thanksgiving holiday brings out the reality of the food, of the culture conflict, and it brings out the way food is used as identity and to promote assimilation. And you get this great picture. Did you guys notice this? I've seen this in other writings about Thanksgiving. You remember this picture on page 9 showing the showing immigrants dressed up as pilgrims. So you just have to imagine Felix Alfino, you know, coming from Sicily as a poor immigrant. Imagine somebody saying, hey, put on this pilgrim outfit. That'll work, you know. Like, okay, great. I'm an American now. So it's kind of a cool story about food and identity. And then you learn that this war with the Pequots, which again gets told really beautifully in this 1491, sad stories, was also food related. Okay, so can we pause on that? Is that any reactions to that? Was some of that news to you, or was what do you think? Let's get our nonverbal up. But, yeah, good. Yeah, good. Okay, so then when you get into the next section, you get to this. One of the things I like about this article is that we hadn't really learned about Galen. So let's get a couple notes on Galen. Oh, yeah, please.
Do they have, like, documentation that there was actually cannibalism? Is that, like...
Oh, right.
Is that a real, like...
Yeah, absolutely. But the cannibalism comes up in Jamestown, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're getting that. Absolutely, yeah.
But I just find it ironic that they wouldn't, like, eat corn because it was, like... Or any of the foods would, like, turn them savage, but... Ironically, they
eat
each other.
Oh, right. Yeah, right.
So funny.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are other examples of cannibalism in food history. It was not uncommon in medieval times when there were famines for people to be selling meat on the street that you would not really ask the provenance of. It would just be young people. And they tasted better. Yeah, so it's not the first group that turned to cannibalism under dire circumstances. Yeah, good point. Yeah, good. Okay, so let's get Galen in the record here. Galen is an ancient Greek physician, and so 400 BC, this is the point for your notes, from 400 BC to 1700 AD, Galen was the smartest information we have about food. I mean, Galen was food nutrition. This was the theory. And it's called the theory of the four humors, right? So there's black bile. Let's see. Let's get this out. Let's get the theory out. So Europeans throughout the Middle Ages, even through the Reformation, up until the invention of chemistry, that's why I say 1700s, 1800s, Galen's the expert. And so what do we know about Galen? Okay, Galen believed there were four humors, black bile, yellow bile. I'm on page 11 here. I'm just going to read the rest of this paragraph. Black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood. These substances became identified with certain organs of the body and with other attributes. Blood and yellow bile were considered to be warm, while black bile and phlegm were cool. Yellow bile and black bile were thought of as dry, and blood and phlegm were considered moist. These are the four humors. Humors were also associated with personality traits. Too much blood was thought to result in the courageous and amorous sanguine personality. So if you're sanguine, you have rosy cheeks, right? And you're cheery. Excess yellow blood turned a person into an irritable choleric. The sluggish phlegmatic suffered from an abundance of phlegm, while the introspective melancholic, those are the philosophers, the introspective melancholic personality had an imbalance of black bile. So both personality disorders and physical illnesses were thought to be the result of disproportionate distribution of these humors. So here's the first point for your notes. I mean, so in general, you're catching this in your notes, that that the humors were connected to illness and personality. So the implication there is that food and psychology are together, right? Food, your diet is your personality. And if you're suffering from a dietary illness, a personality disorder and a dietary illness turn out to be overlapping, right? So there was another detail here I wanted to put in, but and then foods. And then the second point is that foods also were associated with different humors. So foods like garlic and pepper were choleric, and they neutralized phlegm. Wine, which resembles blood, was thought to increase levels of blood, which is pretty crazy. Animals, if you ingested an animal, if you ate an animal, you took on the characteristics of the animal. This is crazy stuff. We believe this, like, until we, even as we're learning chemistry, we still have Galen. We're wondering how to square chemistry with Galen. So the second point would be that food was perceived as affecting character. So when you chose food, you weren't just choosing something to keep you alive. You're choosing something consistent or inconsistent with your personality. Okay. Now, the idea that diet and psychology go together, ironically, is getting some attention with microbiome research, right? Microbiota research, which is suggesting that there is a connection between mental health and the state of your gut. But it is crazy to think that wine fortifies blood, or that, you know, if you eat a rabbit, you're going to become more scared or less courageous. So that's all pretty crazy. One of the humorous theories was that fish reduces carnal desire, which, again, fish is associated with fasting in connection with Christianity, right? So having a fish fast will make you a more spiritual person. So that's, you can see how the humor supported food ideologies about religion and fasting. Okay, questions about that? So that's kind of the first part of that section. And the second part is just this idea that the Iroquois and other Native Americans associated corn with life, their words for it. Remember that our living soil. We were talking about how food can be thought of as living soil. And in 1491, you get the story of the cultivation of corn in Mesoamerica in 5000 BC, and you have people in contemporary Mexico saying, "We're the people of corn. We are corn," you know. And it's kind of cool. It's a way of identifying. So Galen would be okay with this too. You know, it's a way of saying we're the people of this food, and we have stories about that for rice cultures, for wheat cultures. But here's the point in this section. If you're a pilgrim, you associate corn with savages, and you don't even believe it's nutritional, and you don't like the taste of it, and you want your wheat to grow, but the wheat isn't growing, and the wheat has funguses. And so the cuisine of contact was partly about how Europeans could get over their view that the foods that the Native Americans were teaching them how to find and eat were foods suitable for civilized people. Because the assumption was, well, these are foods for savages. And remember, the Indians are engaging in hunting and gathering. They're teaching the pilgrims, hey, you can eat this root. Don't eat this one over here. So they have a tremendous, by today's standard, we know that the Native Americans were well-fed. They have tremendous knowledge of foods. But there was a cultural food identity problem in saying, wow, this is how we're going to survive. And then, like you said, Elizabeth, the irony is that we're just growing corn everywhere we can think to grow it now. Okay? So again, the theme is, you know, food, the theme is the same as from last week, but now we're applying it to American culture. Okay? Okay, you guys with me? Good? So the Jamestown segment, the key thing there is to remember that Jamestown was not a religious colony. Jamestown was a profitable venture that was sponsored by investors in England, and they were expecting a return. So they led it more as an expedition, like a quasi-military expedition for private profit. And like the Pilgrims' experience, the Indians helped. In fact, they helped more substantially in Jamestown like the Pilgrims, the Jamestown settlers didn't really know what they were doing. They chose a bad place to settle the town. They didn't understand how to grow food or find food. So Powhatan, and this is kind of, you guys all got the animated version of this in Pocahontas, right? So Powhatan was he and his people were feeding the colonists. They weren't just giving them tips, they were actually providing them food for the first couple of years. And then the colonists took more. They started raiding Indian villages, they were murdering Indians, and they were basically ravaging communities for food. And so Powhatan says to them, you read this, right? Powhatan says, why are you doing this? We're giving you food. You know, you got a pretty good deal. You don't need to do this. So again, our image, our pre-revisionist image of the Indians as violent savages, which, you know, I mean, they were in some cases very violent. War was part of their culture. But part of we didn't emphasize just how peaceful and helpful Powhatan was in this case. So he finally decides to stop helping, and that's what you did learn about Jamestown, is that the colonists mostly starved in 1609. Reinforcements were sent, but it didn't work out. Part of their problem was that they had upper middle class Englishmen with them who could not imagine getting dirty. You know, like they thought somebody else was going to do the work. And so they were, you know, so they weren't prepared for what they experienced. You do get some interesting details from a captives report. I just wanted to kind of highlight on page 23. So this is a woman that was captured by Native Americans, Mary Rowlandson. And this is great. This will remind you of Jenny Van Cott's bone broth, but it's not the same, okay? They would pick up old bones and cut them into pieces at the joints, and if they were full of worms and maggots, they would scald them over a fire to make the vermin come out, and then boil them and drink up the liquor, which would be the bone broth. It's pretty appetizing. And they would eat horses' guts and ears and all sorts of wild birds which they could catch, also bear, venison, beaver, tortoise, frogs, squirrels, dogs, skunks, rattlesnakes, even the bark off trees. She reports eating deer fetus and bloody horse liver. Again, the Indians were extremely well-nourished. They were pretty healthy. Again, they were susceptible to some diseases from the Europeans, and it was not a culture that was hospitable to people who were weak. It's a kind of warrior culture in a lot of ways, but we know from physical evidence that they were well-fed. So again, the cuisine of contact is a clash of food ideologies, religious ideologies, ideologies about who's civilized. Remember how we started the class with that comment about civility and eating? So the idea that our food is an occasion for communicating our identity, but also our superiority. I mean, people have advocated their diets as better than others consistently, and you find that today. If you meet somebody with a special diet, vegetarianism, veganism, they'll often say, "Wow, when I discovered this, this is the greatest thing. Let me tell you about my diet." It's like the way people talk about religious experiences. You know, the same thing in an evangelical context. Somebody might come up to you and say, "Well, you know, this ever since I started going to this church, it really changed my life. This is the way to live." Okay, come on now, we got a little time. If you have a thought in your head, let's get it out. I mean, not any thought. Okay? It's not a happy story. Maybe that's also part of it. It's like, what do you say? This was not our best moment. I mean, these weren't my people. I'm sure Sicilian immigrants didn't always behave well either. Okay? So, the way it wraps up is just that, you know, there is a new story in the last segment, and it's the Massachusetts Bay Colony. So by the 1640s, now we're a few decades, we're 20 years after the Mayflower, you have this massive Massachusetts Bay Colony, which is a political organization, right? Or way before the Constitutional Congress, right? Another 160 years, 50, 60. And the Massachusetts Bay Colony was a religious confederation. It was a religious political organization. And the key thing for your notes here, which kind of wraps up the, summarizes the Puritan encounter with the Puritan encounter over food in the New World, is that Puritans thought of their morality, the morality in their community, is connected to their food security. Let's get that in your notes. The Puritans connected the morality of their community to their food security. So immoral conduct threatened the food security. Bad food experiences implied that somebody was up to shenanigans, right? Stealing, fornicating, whatever. So the connection went in both directions. And so communal fasting. So you could be voted out of the colony. And there are famous, I'm reading about a guy named Roger Williams, a famous Puritan, who gets voted out of the colony. And then you just have to walk. You have to go meet some Indians and try to get some land from them. And so that was an experience people had. In other words, the building of the city on the hill was such a tight moral community that the importance, the perceived importance of connecting every aspect of moral behavior to the success of food security was so powerful that it's a great example. The point for your notes is it's a great example of how deeply we think food connects us to reality. It wasn't incidental to their religious vision. It got incorporated into their vision of a new city on the hill, a more moral place. And add this little detail, which I should have put in earlier. Part of their vision was to reject the gluttony of the British foods, the British elite. So they saw themselves in terms of purity. You know, they were pursuing a more pure food path. Simple eating is part of the religious purity. You don't need a lot of spices. You don't need a lot of fancy food. That's why we're different. And we're going to, I just want to connect this to Thursday's reading, which I hope you'll enjoy. Thursday we're going to read another chapter from Wallet where she does the best job I've seen of telling the story of the Kellogg's and the Posts in Battle Creek, Michigan. You know, this is the emergence of the industrial cereal system that we get all our boxed extruded cereal from. And I won't give that away. You're going to read it, but I want to just connect the idea of purity here, because Kellogg originally set up a health spa before he got into industrial cereal, and the idea was that we were going to cure the bad diet of the, I think we're talking about late 19th century here. And so you're going to come here and you're going to eat granola, you're going to eat whole wheat bread. So remember that point we started with at the beginning about pure whole foodism being a kind of ideology and a philosophy. And we're going to connect the American concern for pure religious purity in food with another episode of that story where these industrialists, the cereal magnates, the future cereal magnates, Post, Kellogg, and there's another one. Who's the other one? Anyway, where they're just getting going. And how do they sell their product initially? They sell it by saying, well, this is pure, healthy food. It's not adulterated. Okay? I think that's most of what we needed to do. Is there anything in this? I do want to challenge you a little bit here. Is there anything in this story that you can connect to contemporary American food culture? We've talked about purity and the idea that Americans, remember American food culture is both the scene for adulterated food that we've, industrial adulterated food, but it's also the culture that gives rise to organic food and health food fads. Okay, and we've also talked about the irony of our phobia of corn versus our investment in corn today. Is there anything else about this story that you can connect to contemporary, the way Americans think about food today? I think we've done that then. I think a sense of the superiority of our diet, of our industrial diet. And I guess we're learning that might not be true. Okay, let's break there, guys. Okay, see you Thursday. Good luck with your exams and tests this week.
Charles Post was the other serial guy.
Post, yes. Kellogg Post. That's right.
Can I ask you a question about the essay?
Sure. You bet.
So I didn't see when you sent out that email about the group.
Okay.
But I think I turned it in.
There? Okay.
Yeah.
It's there? Good. Okay.
So
you weren't one of, no, I haven't done any grading yet. So did you, so did I indicate that yours was missing?
Well, let me check. I didn't see my animal name, so I assumed that my name had got it.
Yeah, let's see if it's there. Just look.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you see your saint name here? Okay, then I've got it.
Those are the missing ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read that at 10 this morning, and I haven't had
my
coffee.
That's okay. That's great.
I was really worried.
That's good.